Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. In less than a month, 20 Democratic presidential candidates will debate here in South Florida. Now, a few of the candidates have already paid a visit to the region. This week, the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, Pete Buttigieg, was campaigning in the Wynwood neighborhood of Miami.
This is one of the most remarkably diverse places in the country. And so making sure that we reach out to people of all backgrounds is going to be really vital to demonstrating how we think a better kind of politics that is inclusive and that is unifying can work for the road ahead.
Former Vice President Joe Biden was also in South Florida this week, speaking at a private fundraiser in Coral Gables. New York Senator Kirsten Gillibrand was in the region raising money recently, and last month, Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar also stopped in. Winning Florida is key to a successful presidential run for the Democrats, and winning decisively with big turnout in South Florida is key for a Democratic ticket. There are lots of candidates running on the Democratic side. Which one stands out for you early on? What issues are most important to you in the 2020 election? Early on here, are you hearing any of those issues being articulated on the Democratic side? Are you donating money to any of the two dozen candidates running for that nomination in these early stages? 800-743-WLRN. That's our telephone number to join our program by your voice, 800-743-9576. You can also send us a text at 786-786-7636. Just let us know your first name and where you're texting from at 786-786-7636. Sun Sentinel opinion writer Sergio Bustos is back with us on the South Florida Roundup, as well as Miami Herald's political reporter David Smiley from our studios inside the Miami Herald in Doral. Gentlemen, to both of you, welcome back to the Roundup. David, let me begin with you. Mayor Pete in town this week, the vice president in town this week, Senator Gillibrand and Klobuchar were in town over the past couple of weeks. What are their messages and what's their strategy here? Is it votes and money, or is it just one or the other at this point?
Mostly it's money. There's still not a lot of organizing going on in Florida, but there is a lot of money to be had. And so mostly they're just trying to pad their pocketbooks being down here. But, you know, for Cory Booker, Amy Klobuchar, they are, you know, holding public events to also try to get their name out down here. Joe Biden doesn't really have that problem. Yeah. So, you know, they did have the press cover his fundraiser in Miami, but, you know, mostly he's just concerned with raising money, and he raised a lot of it.
So, Sergio, so early, raising a lot of money, are they putting any of that money back to work here in South Florida?
It's hard to tell at this point, but what seems to me is they're all grasping for money. What, it's two dozen candidates now. You know, you don't need a scorecard. You need an entire kind of playbook to figure out who's
You need
who's
a playbill
running.
Almost at this point.
Exactly. But in terms of the money, you know, I'm going to be curious to see how many can survive, because all these the big money people are going to probably hold off until this field kind of whittles down with so many. And judging from that last Florida Atlantic University poll, it really, you know, at this point, and again, it's just a poll, but Biden, you know, far in front of everyone, along with Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, Kamala Harris, and Mr. Mayor Pete Buttigieg.
Yeah. What about Mayor Pete's performance here? What about the messages, David Smiley, that you're hearing from these candidates who are making public appearances in South Florida?
Well, there are Democrats down here who are supporting him, who feel like he's got the kind of face and message that they want the party to project going forward. A lot of hope, a lot of new politics type messaging. But, you know, one of our columnists, Fabiola Santiago, wrote a column about the fact that neither Buttigieg nor Biden came down here talking about issues important to certain demographics in the community. Neither of them talked about Venezuela or Cuba. And I've always thought that that's a mistake, to come down here and give a sort of boilerplate message for these candidates, particularly a Buttigieg, who can probably make some, you know, carve a name out for himself among the field by coming down here and doing that. And really, they just brought their standard campaign stump.
And Sergio, is that stump resonating at all with South Florida Democrats who any of these candidates are going to need to show up in droves come the 2020 election cycle in November.
What's really unusual about this race is that, for at least Democrats, it doesn't matter issues, because if you look at them in general, they're all the same. They're not in disagreement. You can argue about some points here. The bottom line is every Democrat wants to beat Trump in November. That's the issue.
But there's only one Democrat that's really been very vocal on that. I mean, they all have made the case, but the vice president, Joe Biden, from the get-go has made essentially that the focal point of his campaign.
Right. And that's what people want to hear.
Yeah.
Because at the end of the day, whether it's, Pelosi, House Speaker Pelosi trying to impeach the president up in Washington, bottom line is come November 2020, that's the main issue. Beat Trump. And at this point, it's interesting about Buttigieg. He has I've not seen any real positions on issues. He's just kind of declaring, kind of putting out the narrative out there. Mm-hmm. And it seems to be working, better than Miramar's mayor, Wayne Messam.
Right. How about that, David? The South Floridian in the race here has been awfully quiet.
Yeah. I think mostly when people talk about Wayne Messam, it's to point out that nobody knows who he is, even in South Florida. And, I think maybe he could have had a shot to make the debates if he had put forward a good campaign, but it doesn't seem like he's doing much. On the messaging point, I would say that I think Ron DeSantis just showed that voters don't hold it against you if you don't have a ton of, a substance behind your policies, that for the most part, it's a popularity contest, and people just, if you can connect with them, a lot of times if you're talking about positions at this point, I think you're probably losing.
Fair enough. David Smiley, covering politics with our partner, the Miami Herald, Sergio Bustos, opinion writer at the South Florida Sun Sentinel. Your phone calls and texts and tweets also. Adam in Miami Beach has been patient. Go ahead, Adam. You're watching and listening all this happen and fully engaged. What are your thoughts?
I disagree completely. I think that issues are what are going to make this campaign, and I think that's the huge mistake the Democratic Party made before. If you look at the person who's the front runner now, for example, Joe Biden, he voted for NAFTA. Hillary Clinton supported NAFTA. In the third debate, she was asked about NAFTA, and she didn't even think it affected American workers, and we lost the Midwest, for heaven's sake. There are two candidates only who are interested in things that will affect all of the people of America. It's Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. For example, they support health care for everyone. They support laws that will make sure that everyone has fair access to our economy. And let me give you just one example. Look at Cory Booker. When Bernie Sanders introduced an amendment in the Senate to allow people to get prescription drugs from Canada, Cory Booker voted against it. 10 Democrats voted against it. You know who supports that? Our governor.
Right.
We have Republicans who are to the left of the main Democratic Party candidates now. And the National Democratic Party has shown that they are willing to throw away the Senate race in Texas, to throw away the race in Montana, to throw away the race in Georgia, anything to stop having Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren in. And it's a disaster because they support working people, and that's who we need.
Adam, thanks for that. We appreciate that. David Smiley, what about what Adam puts voice to there, the Bernie Sanders 2020 and Elizabeth Warren? They have been relatively quiet here in South Florida in this cycle, but that's going to turn up the heat in the next 3 weeks or so as we move toward the debates coming up in late June.
Yeah, I think for people who want to hear policy and positions, they're going to have plenty of chance to do that at the end of June when everyone comes down here. And the campaigns, especially the campaigns that need to make some noise, are looking at that as a bit of a tipping point or a point of demarcation for whether they can, go forward or, maybe it's time to bow out. But I think, he's making the point about the importance of issues and positions, but the polls have shown right now that most people, as Sergio pointed out, I think are looking at who can beat Trump. And that doesn't necessarily require a 50-point bullet plan behind, your immigration position, as, Julian Castro has put out. That doesn't mean he's still not doing very well in the polls, despite having a very detailed policy plan on education and immigration. So that might be what some voters want, but it's not necessarily what the majority of voters want at this point.
Sergio?
Yeah, I mean, look at someone like Mayor Pete Buttigieg. He's come out with a very strong narrative, being a veteran, gay, running a small town. Granted, it's South Bend, Indiana. It's not some big city. But just that alone has given enough narrative that people even know who he is, and they even know how to pronounce his name. You know, that's pretty good.
Yeah, it is pretty good, given that the difficulty that we've had with that. 800-743-9576, that's the phone number if you want to join us on the voice line, 800-743-9576. The Week in Politics, Presidential Politics with South Florida in focus. Again, several candidates visiting South Florida, trying to raise their profile amongst voters and especially amongst donors. And 20 of those candidates will be in town in about three and a half weeks or so, with the first Democratic debate to be held over two nights in the city of Miami. The text line, 786-786-7636. Which candidate has grabbed your attention or your ear, or for that matter, you're turning off to for whatever reason? 786-786-7636 is the text line. Just let us know your first name and where you are texting from. David, what does the calendar look like over the next 3 weeks as the Democrats move toward this big debate? And how important is that debate here in Florida to garner support amongst South Floridian Democrats and to find that turnout, which is going to be important come November of 2020?
Well, I haven't seen the campaigns announcing events publicly, but my understanding is that, you know, candidates have been telling their supporters that they want to hold fundraising and, you know, be around the area around the time of the debates, mm-hmm. which obviously are happening over 2 days. So I would expect to have an active calendar down here to have a number of public events and private fundraisers for everyone to try to make the most of their opportunity down here. But, you know, as I said earlier, I do think that, you know, for some of the fringe candidates, particularly the ones that are having problems or raising money, or maybe aren't raising money as much compared to some of the other big hitters, that you know, making some kind of a splash, getting some attention, getting people interested in them. Sergio talked about Buttigieg being able to get people interested in him. That's really just the key at this point, is making people intrigued and getting them to want to know more about you, leaving people wanting.
What does it say for the DNC, the Democratic National Committee, to hold that first series of debates, because it's going to be two nights in Miami, as opposed to Wisconsin or Pennsylvania, two other key states that emerged in 2016 as places that the Democrats and the Clinton campaign was accused of ignoring, not paying enough attention to during that campaign?
I think in 2016, while Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan drew the headlines, remember, there was a lot of attention placed on Florida.
Oh, yeah.
And remember that Trump did not win Florida by a huge, you know, a huge percentage. So I think there is the feeling he can come back, and why not bring it down here? The population keeps growing. The number of voters, it's a huge win if they can get it. And anything to bring more attention in here is better for the Democrats.
It's kind of a consolation prize, too, I think, for not having the convention.
Right, because Miami Beach was in the running for the convention in 2020. Good point. David Smiley, watching politics. He's going to stick with us, as is Sergio Bustos, opinion writer for the South Florida Sun Sentinel. We're going to talk a little bit about politics and international relations when it comes to state government. Governor DeSantis leaves for Israel this weekend. Agriculture and technology are on the minds as the governor, lawmakers, and lobbyists all head to Jerusalem and elsewhere in Israel. That's coming up on the South Florida Roundup after this. Stay tuned. We're back here on the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Thanks again for listening and supporting public radio. I'm Tom Hudson. Governor Ron DeSantis and his delegation of dozens of Floridians will be leaving for Israel tomorrow on Saturday. More than 90 people are expected to join, including lobbyists, lawmakers, and business owners. The governor's office released the official itinerary just this week. It's now being called a trade mission. The visit also will include a Florida cabinet meeting, a ceremonial one. Shortly after the trip was announced, WLRN spoke with Lior Hayat. He's Israel's general counsel here in Miami, and he said Florida has a lot to take away from Israel, particularly when it comes to agriculture and water.
There's a lot of new technology based in Israel that is very relevant to Florida, both on the red tide and the algaes. It's also for the greening of oranges. This is a huge problem here.
One scheduled meeting on Wednesday of next week has raised some concerns. It involves cabinet members and whether that violates open meeting laws here back home in Florida. A spokesman for the governor has said the meeting is ceremonial and no action will be taken involving state business. So what do you think about all this? Florida's relationship to Israel. Have you traveled there? What could the country offer the state of Florida? Do you support this kind of trade mission? 800-743-WLRN is the phone number. Voice line at 800-743-9576. The text line, 786-786-7636. Text us your first name and where you're texting from and your thoughts at 786-786-7636. One of those packing his bags is the Bell Harbor Mayor, Gabriel Groisman. He joins us now. Your Honor, thanks for joining us on the South Florida Roundup. What do you anticipate being a result of this trade mission to Israel for Bell Harbor?
Thanks for having me on. The trade mission is really an opportunity to open and continue to strengthen economic, business, and personal ties between the entire Florida community, the South Florida community, and, of course, the Bell Harbor community. And it's another step in a long relationship between Florida and the state of Israel and the residents of Florida and the state of Israel. And I think it's really a great thing that the governor is doing, not just because he said he was going to do it, but also because, you know, one of his primary jobs as governor is to generate business for the state of Florida. And I'm lucky enough to be in Israel several times a year for personal reasons, and there our country is knocking on Israel's door every single day looking to do business with the state of Israel. So this is a great opportunity for the state of Florida.
Is there something tangible that you expect to bring back for the residents of Bell Harbor for this trip?
Look, not specifically. What I'm trying to do for the residents of Bell Harbor is to open doors and to seek opportunities for different residents here and see how we can continue to work the relationships between the residents of Bell Harbor and Bell Harbor as a municipality itself,
yeah,
and the state of Israel.
What kind of doors, Mr. Mayor?
Look, the details of the trip still haven't been released, as far as I understand. So, you know, I'm not sure what it
is. Aren't you getting on a plane tomorrow, though?
I am getting on a plane tomorrow night, yes. And we're meeting with universities and with business leaders from many different sectors.
So when you say that the full itinerary hasn't been released, give me a sense of what does that look like for you? I mean, do you anticipate additional meetings being set up, or give us a sense of what that looks like?
My understanding is we'll be having, as a group and individually, have the opportunities to have meetings with different business leaders in Israel and universities. We have, I think, almost every, if not every, university from the state of Florida with representatives that will be coming as well. None of these relationships happen with one meeting, right? But this,
yeah,
is a way to plant the seed.
For a community, a small community like Bell Harbor, Mayor Groisman, how did you get involved in this pretty high-profile trip for the new governor?
I've been involved with issues of the Jewish community and with the state of Israel for many, many years. As of late, I was very involved with the passage of the anti-Semitism bill in the state of Florida with Representative Randy Fine. In fact, in Bell Harbor, we're the first to codify that definition of anti-Semitism. And we've been working with the governor and with the state for quite some time.
This is a new piece of legislation. There's lots of constitutional questions around it, and I'd like to get your opinion on that, Mr. Mayor. It had been our understanding that Governor DeSantis may sign this legislation during this trip. Is that your understanding?
You know, I don't know. I'm hearing both things. I'm hearing he's going to sign it on the trip, and I'm hearing also there won't be any official cabinet meeting. So I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah. Well, I don't think he needs a cabinet meeting to sign the legislation into law. But there have been some constitutional questions about this piece of legislation in even the staff analysis of the proposed bill several weeks ago before lawmakers even voted on it. Some of the staff analysis in Tallahassee raised questions about the constitutionality of this. Are you concerned about that?
No, not at all. And the staff analysis that you're reading was from the original bill, mm-hmm, more than several weeks ago, from the beginning of the session. And anyone who reads the final bill will realize that there is no constitutional question about it at all. It doesn't inhibit free speech at all. This is really just putting in a definition for anti-Semitism. And the final bill, as it was passed, simply says that in K-20 institutions in the state of Florida, you shall treat racism, anti-Semitism, the same way you treat racism,
In public education facilities. Finally, Mr. Mayor, who's picking up the tab for you?
Me, myself, and I. No one's paying for it. Not my city, not the state of Florida, not Enterprise Florida. I'm paying for it out of pocket. It's an opportunity of a lifetime, and I'm looking forward to it.
Bell Harbor Mayor Gabrielle Groysman, Your Honor, thank you for joining us. Travel safely, okay?
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. So, talking about the governor here moving taking a trip to Israel, the first international trade mission for the new governor. Danny Rivero from WLRN joins us now. Danny, you did some lots of reporting on this initially, and if memory serves right, it began as a cabinet meeting for the new governor and has evolved now into what may be a pretty significant trade mission with a cabinet ceremony.
Well, Governor DeSantis, even on the campaign trail, he stated very clearly, he said, you know, my first trade mission abroad will be to Israel. And early on, when he made the first announcement, he did announce that they're going to do a cabinet meeting. But there was a trade component to it. It wasn't exactly clear. We didn't have many details of what that entailed, who was going to join, what the purpose of the trip specifically would be. But now it's very much kind of both. It's a cabinet meeting, which is being played up as very historically significant, and then also kind of played down that it's not that important. It's just ceremonial. Don't worry about the open government questions. But now it's a little bit of both things at the same time.
David Smiley, covering politics for our partner, the Miami Herald. A cabinet meeting in name only, but not in action.
Yeah, I think the waffling around that suggests that they are a little concerned about the Sunshine Law, even though they've consistently said that there would be no violation in holding a cabinet meeting in Israel. I honestly don't understand. They could accomplish all the same things in both their trade mission and politically without doing the cabinet meeting in Israel. So I don't really get why they're doing it. But I guess people attending the trip don't really know what they're doing on the trip either. So
that's what we just heard from the mayor, right? He was going to get on a plane in about 24 hours here as we're talking on this Friday afternoon. Still without a real clear itinerary, Sergio.
Yeah, I think as David and Danny said, at the beginning, there was a lot of emphasis on this cabinet meeting and the fact that they've added ceremonial. I think that's a credit really to the media in Florida that really jumped on it when DeSantis offered up this trip as a way to hold this cabinet meeting there because of all the Sunshine Law violations that could pop up. But by putting ceremonial, I think he's trying to protect himself from it, and then really emphasizing trade takes away some of that heat.
Governor Rick Scott held a number of pretty high-profile trade missions, going to Asia, going to Latin America, going elsewhere, this being the governor's first trade mission, and it being to Israel. Sergio, how significant is that? Tell us kind of what are the peripheral politics look like around that?
Well, obviously, any trip to Israel is a good thing for a politician in Florida to woo Jewish voters. You know, huge Jewish constituency here in South Florida, especially. Also, the idea of any governor going out and promoting jobs is not a, you know, it's always a good thing. Mm-hmm. Keep in mind, Scott would even go inside the United States and try to steal.
He did trade missions to Texas and California, New York, right.
And he got into tiffs with them.
Yeah.
So it will be curious to see, you know, how DeSantis does this. But obviously, a trade mission around, you know, it's not going to be his last, and it's certainly welcome for Florida.
Yeah, David Smiley, the governor, as his walk up to announcing even this trip was very critical of policies of Airbnb, which is a company that has a significant presence here in Florida, obviously with the tourism industry. So how is all that, you know, what are the lenses that are being used here for this trip?
Well, you know, DeSantis, when he was in Congress, on the campaign trail, you know, very aggressively courted Jewish voters, aligned himself with Israel, you know, talked a lot about his wife bringing back water from the Sea of Galilee, mm-hmm. with which to baptize their daughter, or maybe it was their son, I can't remember. But apparently, I think the maids actually ended up throwing out that bottle of water at the governor's mansion, so I guess that never happened. But, you know, I think he feels like that was a successful strategy in a state where races are decided by very slim margins. Republicans, it was never clear whether it was DeSantis' campaign or not, but, you know, very aggressively went after Andrew Gillum over his ties to, you know, the boycott, divest, and sanctions movement and to the Dream Defenders. And they're going to continue to hit those notes through 2020.
The phone number 800-743-9576. Do you support the governor's trip to Israel? What would you like to see come of it? 800-743-9576 or the text line 786-786-7636. Text us your first name and where you're texting from at 786-786-7636. Danny Rivero, all right, all this happening with a changing geopolitics, certainly when it comes to the United States and Mideast relations. And the president, President Trump, recently trying to broker yet another peace plan. What are the risks? What are the rewards? How does a governor, even a governor of a state as important as Florida is to the president, but also to the national economy, how does the governor kind of fit into that or find himself potentially within that geopolitical chess game?
Well, I think officially the answer is not much at all.
Yeah.
A governor on paper shouldn't have a whole lot to do with foreign policy, but that's officially. There's the political social reality to this that perception means a lot. And Governor DeSantis, when you know he ran on being the most pro-Israel governor in the country during the campaign trail against Mayor Andrew Gillum, mm-hmm. he used Gillum's kind of ties with the BDS, the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement, in order to kind of as a wedge issue to separate himself a little bit politically and to align Republicans a little bit more closely with being pro-Israel and to make Democrats out to be as something else. It's worth noting on that same note that Nikki Fried, the only Democrat that won statewide election, also ran on the platform of being very pro-Israel, yep. also saying she was going to make her first trade mission abroad to the state of Israel. She's actually there now. She's doing kind of a separate trip. Hmm. She's already there touring facilities, talking with company leaders. She's looking to get any investments in technologies that can help Florida with citrus greening, problems with blue-green algae. Yep. She's already doing that separately, and she's going to meet up with the rest of the cabinet towards the end of the trip for this cabinet meeting.
The ceremonial cabinet meeting, right? Exactly. David Smiley, how about kind of measuring the impact of this? I think, you know, this is noteworthy for multiple reasons. It's the governor's first international trip as governor. He's been very vocal about taking this to Israel, to Jerusalem specifically. But as the governor kind of, you know, comes back and winds through his tenure, how should we look at this, do you think?
Well, I think he's been smart so far, and I would fully expect that he will come back with some accomplishments to hold out to show here's why we went.
Yeah.
We know reporters are going to find out how much it costs the state. And if he doesn't come back with some accomplishments, it's going to look like he took a junket with 100 people, including the president of FPL mm-hmm. and some other, you know, significant lobbyists to Israel. And I'm sure that they don't want that. They don't want it to turn into a negative. So I don't know what he'll have to hold up for people to say that it was worth going, but I would be surprised if he doesn't have something to show for his efforts.
If I can jump in there, when I talked to the Consul General Lior Hayat, he mentioned, and then he kind of rescinded it, I think he opened his mouth a little too quickly, that there's going to be 10 memorandums of understanding signed between universities and companies here in Florida and their counterparts in Israel. So that's something. And another thing we know is that there in 2013, the state of Florida signed an MOU, a memorandum of understanding with Israel in regards to space travel.
Mm.
And Israel just launched 2 months ago, I think at this point, their first moon mission out of here in Florida. And we're expecting when DeSantis is there that they're going to that he's going to announce that the state of Florida is giving grants to some Israeli companies who are doing business here in the space travel sphere. So this is obviously in the on the backdrop of trying to woo the Space Force, the branch of the military into Florida, that this could be potentially a big part of the economy. There's, I mean, attracting technology companies that have that kind of business line in space, that could be potentially very big for the state.
It's pretty standard operating procedure for any kind of trade mission to have secured deals before they even leave their home state, in this case, Sergio Bustos. We saw that pretty consistently with Governor Scott and other governors in the past. That's just kind of a normal thing. And Danny mentioned some of those memorandums that are probably in the offing here that we're expected to see in kind of tangible results after the fact. But they're, you know, put in place before you even get wheels up out of Florida into Israel. Pretty standard here. But what about the role of the Economic Development Group in Florida, Enterprise Florida? Some folks there are on this trip, and this has been a place where the Scott administration and previous Republican leaders in Tallahassee have been very, very critical. And now maybe that tune is changing to some degree?
To some degree. I think it's still always a tough sell because of the use of tax dollars to offer incentives to businesses is what places like Enterprise Florida do. What I was going to say, though, is DeSantis has already chalked up one in the win column with this Airbnb fight. Airbnb had decided to remove listings of properties in Israeli settlements in the West Bank. And DeSantis came out really tough against it and using the power of Florida's to do that, and as it turned out last month, Airbnb reversed its decision.
Yeah.
So it's things like this, as opposed to maybe the bigger Middle East policy and all the things that I think will help him in the long run, and then any jobs he can bring to Florida are certainly going to be welcomed.
Siobhan in Hollywood on line one, go ahead, Siobhan, you're on the radio. Your thoughts.
Good afternoon. It just seems to be just an absolute boondoggle and a great expense to the state of Florida. If the agriculture commissioner is already doing some of the same work. The guest speaker, the mayor of Bal Harbour, I believe, doesn't have an agenda or an itinerary the day before. How much thought and plans went into this? And the cost is just absolutely outrageous. And just you can imagine what the cost would be.
Siobhan, thanks for that. As the mayor of Bal Harbour did mention, he himself and I are paying for that. In other words, he's paying for his trip personally, not the residents of Bal Harbour or the state of Florida. Different, certainly, probably for those folks within the governor's office, David Smiley. What do we know about the cost? I think one reporter, I think, called or looked online at the hotel in Tel Aviv that they're due to stay at, and I think the cheapest rate was $500-$600 a night.
Yeah, I know the governor's office has, I believe, said that a majority of the people attending, it's maybe 90 to 100, are paying their own way, or at least not being footed by the state. I guess State Representative Joe Geller told our colleague Emily Mahoney from the Tampa Bay Times that he's, I think, spending about $5,000 out of his state legislative fund. So it... If we assume everybody's somewhere around there, you can get a guess at what 5,000 times 100 might cost.
Yeah.
But that's not necessarily all taxpayer money.
Right. Some of that is going to be private individuals or private money. But when talking about the representative using legislative fund, trace that money for us, David.
Yeah, I mean, these guys have office accounts
right.
That they can use at their discretion, and that is taxpayer money. So I think if Joe Geller's constituents are okay with him using that money, and they probably are, in his district, then he's good to go. But we're gonna find out the total costs of the trip eventually.
Yeah.
Once they're done, when they're putting in for reimbursement.
Yeah, I would say ceremonial or not, that paperwork goes through, and that will see the sunshine once it once it hits those servers in Tallahassee, and the reporters take a look at it. David Smiley, following politics for our partner, the Miami Herald. Great to have you back on the program, David.
Yeah, good to be here.
Sergio Bustos, opinion writer with the South Florida Sun-Sentinel. Thanks for taking some time out, Sergio. Thanks.
Thanks for the invitation.
And Danny Rivera, always great reporting. Thanks for sharing it with us here at WLRN.
Thanks, Tom.
Lots more to come here on the Roundup. Stick with us. The David Beckham Group has three stadium sites in the works for Miami's MLS soccer team. Where do you want to see professional soccer return to South Florida? That's next on The Roundup. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks, as always, for listening and supporting public radio. So where will professional soccer be played in South Florida long term? It will kick off in Fort Lauderdale, that we know, but the team, including David Beckham, want to bring it to Miami, and they have two sites in mind. Earlier this week, one of the team's leaders, Jorge Mas, told Miami-Dade County officials there are plans to close on the purchase of about 3 acres of county land in the city's Overtown neighborhood. That was Beckham's choice to build a soccer stadium up until early 2018. Partners then went on to pursue the city-owned Mel Reese Golf Course by Miami International Airport. That site still needs a plan and city approval. The third stadium site, well, that's already been decided. Earlier this month, Fort Lauderdale City Commissioners agreed to deal to redevelop Lockhart Stadium, where the team will begin play for its first two seasons. So if you live near one of these sites, if you're a soccer fan, where would you like to see Major League Soccer land full-time, long-term in South Florida? The ball continues to bounce between at least three locations spread across two counties. Where should Major League Soccer have a stadium in South Florida? 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. You can also text us with your first name where you're texting from at 786-786-7636. Again, the text line, 786-786-7636. Brian Bandel reports on all things real estate for the South Florida Business Journal and is back with us here on the South Florida Roundup. What are the deals? What are the details that we know of in regards to this Overtown site that I think so many folks had kind of moved beyond, but in fact there was still kind of some simmering here, it sounds like.
Yeah, I mean, in fact, Jorge Mas kind of downplayed that site and badmouthed that site in public a couple times, talking about why he wanted the voters to approve Mel Reese, which they did. So the Beckham Group has that property under contract for a total of about $9 million from the county. They won a no-bid deal to get it. They overcame a lawsuit from Booth Matheson that tried to stop them from getting it. And now that they've done that, they've told the mayor they want to close on it, and they potentially could do that. However, the agreement says that they have to build a stadium. They have to spend $175 million. They have to hire local people. So it's a little confusing to say, well, we want Overtown and we also want Mel Reese.
Are they still negotiating the Mel Reese plan? Because what voters approved for the city of Miami was to allow the city of Miami to negotiate exclusively with the Beckham Jorge Mas group regarding the potential of a stadium. Didn't necessarily put a stadium in Mel Reese, but it allows the negotiations to move forward.
And that's the thing. They're further along in Overtown than they are in Mel Reese. So the priority is Mel Reese. They want it. But they need four votes on the city commission. Right now, and they got three votes to put it on the ballot. Right now, those two commissioners, Reyes and Gort, don't seem very supportive. I don't know if they'll change their mind. Reyes probably won't change his mind. He seems very much against it. But if they don't change their mind, what do you tell Major League Soccer that they promised them a stadium in Miami? You tell them, we have Overtown. If they don't give us Mel Reese, if it falls apart, Overtown will work out fine. Don't worry about it.
Is this a negotiating tactic? In other words, if you're negotiating, you'd rather have two options to negotiate as opposed to just one?
I think you want a fallback option because, you know, they only got the franchise because it was going to be in Miami. They didn't award them the franchise because it was the Fort Lauderdale MLS. It was because it was Miami. So if they can't get, they want to show Major League Soccer they have a site in Miami. And as a bonus, the fact that Overtown is an opportunity zone where you could get a massive amount of tax savings by building and selling a team there. I think that's a nice little bonus.
Brittany Wallman is joining us now via Skype. She's a reporter for the South Florida Sun-Sentinel. Brittany, how did this news go over in Fort Lauderdale, which is busy trying to fix up Lockhart Stadium so that the Miami team can have kickoff there for the first two seasons? Brittany, can you hear us okay?
I can.
Yeah. So how did this news that the Overtown potential stadium site remains in play, how did that news go over in Fort Lauderdale, where the work is underway to get that stadium up and running, Lockhart Stadium, for the MLS Miami team for its first two seasons?
You know, I did not hear a peep about it because, you know, it's almost irrelevant in Broward what happens with the date situation. Broward could benefit, in fact, if there's delay in getting you know, the permanent stadium down there, because it's just more years that they might play in Fort Lauderdale.
So describe that a little bit more, right? Like, what is the agreement in Fort Lauderdale, and, you know, whether or not this presents a real viable third option as the team continues to try to negotiate a more permanent home in Miami?
Okay, sure. Because I think some people have this feeling that I've heard some people call the Fort Lauderdale Stadium the temporary stadium mm-hmm. for the team, or, mm-hmm. you know, that it's just for 2 years. This is the training complex. So regardless, they were going to build a stadium there, a prefab modular stadium for the farm teams. So this just means that Beckham's team would play, they're saying they would play at least the first 2 seasons there. I spoke with a city official and also with someone from the Beckham group in the last day or two. They're busy demolishing the stadiums that are there now. They're negotiating with the city. They're not even talking about what's going on in Miami-Dade. They're moving forward. They are on a very ambitious timeline to get this Fort Lauderdale stadium up by next February.
800-743-9576 is the voice line. Joining our conversation about where MLS is going to land and where it is negotiating to land in the seasons ahead for Major League Soccer and David Beckham, Jorge Mas, and their team of investors. 800-743-9576. This is a conversation that I think we're 4.5, 5 years on in this latest iteration here in South Florida. Text line is 786-786-7636. Text us your first name and where you're texting from and your thoughts and questions at 786-786-7636. Brian Bendel, I from the South Florida Business Journal, I mentioned that time frame here because it has been an enormous amount of work, some delay as well, and we still don't have Major League Soccer yet. How is the community, how's the real estate community even hearing this back and forth? And, you know, you cover real estate for a living. For those of us who are looking at this as spectators, is this kind of back and forth normal with these size of these deals?
And if you look at the history of South Florida, it is pretty normal for major projects that are almost handed to us to go back and forth. If you might remember about a decade ago, the Scripps Research Institute in Palm Beach County, you know, a total different political body, but they went back and forth for a long time on where they should go. So, you know, for a while, the Marlins went back and forth, although the Marlins were asking for public handouts too, and Beckham is not asking for, you know, any money from the county at least. So this has happened a lot before. So I think it does say something about, you know, the reputation of, it's not necessarily easy to do business here when you have to go through the politicians.
That's got to play well in Broward County, doesn't it, Brittany?
Well, absolutely. I mean, you know, I may end up eating these words, but this whole mess in Miami-Dade has been a gift for Fort Lauderdale because as part of this deal, you know, I think it that's why Beckham's group landed in Fort Lauderdale and made a bid successfully for that property. Is just sitting there waiting for them. And, you know, they're going to be building the city a park and the city is getting a community center and they're going to put in a pool. And, you know, so it's just happy days up here.
A little bit of a contrary call here from Joseph and Kendall. Joseph, thanks for calling in. You're not ready to make that trek from Kendall up to Lockhart Stadium to watch the team?
I just don't see it. I had the privilege of getting into the celebration when they got the MLS franchise, and they celebrated at the Arch Center in downtown Miami, and I know they packed the place, literally packed the place, and I just do not see it. And unfortunately, I think that this is my personal opinion because I don't know these people personally, but I think from the time the Moss family got into it, I think they've driven it back towards the opposite goal line many times. And I even said to friends that because of what Moss is, you hear very little positive with the Moss family. Everything is 11th hour, last minute. And I hate to say this because I love MLS and I love the World Cup, but I don't see it happening with them at the steering wheel. I really don't.
Joseph, thanks for the thoughts here. Tom in Miami, you are willing to make that drive up to Fort Lauderdale to watch professional soccer.
Absolutely. I would drive to, I'd get the turnpike or whatever, go to Fort Lauderdale. I think Fort Lauderdale is a much more interesting place. I've lived here since 74. I've never seen any really interest in soccer. Because basically one particular country group has no interest in it. And in the long run, that shows. It's nothing against them. It's just that you know, it's the non-Cuban Hispanics interested in this, and the Cubans aren't interested. So I think Fort Lauderdale is very interesting. I don't think here anyone's going to miss it. Cubans in particular. Hmm. So I think we got to be practical. Fort Lauderdale is a great place. They're going to like it more. They're going to be more interested. Beckham's going to be happier. We're not going to have any political problems in terms of who likes soccer and who doesn't. And yeah. I'm the type that follows every single World Cup, every big championship, every WIFA, whatever it is, I follow it.
I think the tough part will be the kids. I mean, imagine you're a talented soccer player, and Kendall, you have to drive to Fort Lauderdale to practice. I think that'll be where the challenge is.
Yeah, Brittany, I'd like you to address that when it comes to the training facility that they want to put in. You know, for those of us who are soccer parents, and there's lots of soccer parents out there potentially listening on the rebroadcast on a Saturday morning when they're off on a Memorial Day weekend, traveling hundreds of miles, spending perhaps hundreds or thousands of dollars for their 10 or 11-year-old or 12-year-old to go play in a soccer tournament along far, far away. So there may be that support, that parental support, to go ahead and make that bi-weekly or tri-weekly drive from Kendall up to Lockhart Stadium if your kid gets into a facility or gets into a training program that features a potential appearance by a David Beckham, for instance.
Well, exactly. As you note, parents of kids that are in any travel sport are going all over the place. So this training facility is not that far off 95. It should be an easier in and out than maybe something in Miami-Dade. I think people will be willing to do that.
We've got a text from Kyle, 305. I think it's better to be in Broward so that soccer can capitalize on the fan base coming from the Tri-County area. It's really hard for people to come to Dade County all the way from Palm Beach County. Certainly Broward County is more centrally located, but professional sports in Broward County, Brittany, don't have a great record of sustainability.
Well, we have the Panthers.
They're not tearing it up with attendance, exactly.
No, that's true. I mean, it remains to be seen whether there's the fan support for this. But, you know, from Fort Lauderdale's perspective, there's not a lot of risk. This is not... So, you know, they're tearing down something that's not even being used, and they're going to get a high school football stadium out of the deal. They're going to get things out of the deal. So I think that it's low risk on their part.
It is a redevelopment project in Lockhart Stadium. It would be a significant change, Brian Bandel, to put a stadium in this area of Overtown. Where are the neighbors in this discussion? Where's the community, the more local community of where these stadiums could go in these conversations?
Now, the funny part is 2 years ago when they got the Overtown deal, they were very involved in the neighbors. They were meeting with them. They had all kinds of meetings. And then Jorge Mas got involved and they pivoted towards Mel Reese, and they haven't really engaged with the Overtown. They haven't held those meetings. So it's a real question. Would they pivot back to Overtown? Would they hold meetings again? And would they have a new vision? Because if they put the stadium in Overtown, there has to be a lot of infrastructure to make it walkable, where you would go from the Culver Metro Rail station or from downtown Miami and walk to that property. It's not walkable today, but it could be walkable. But they need a lot of work, and they need the work to the community.
And Brittany, just final 20 seconds, what about the involvement in the surrounding community around Lockhart?
Well, remember, Lockhart is an airport site,
right?
So it has all the ambiance of sitting next to a runway.
But this is being seen, though, and being projected in some corners as a real economic redevelopment magnet.
Absolutely. This is up by Cypress Creek. There's 70,000 jobs up there. There's a vision to really get some development going, and I was told that three residential developers said that they are now ready to build up there because of this. Hmm.
Brittany Wallman, reporter for the South Florida Sun Sentinel, with us via Skype. Brittany, great to have you on the program, as always.
Thanks
so much. Brian Bandel, covering all things real estate with the South Florida Business Journal. Brian, thanks for sharing your reporting with us as well. Nice to have you back.
Thank you.
That'll do it for the South Florida Roundup this week. It is produced by Alexander Gonzalez. Our engagement producer is Katie Lepre, Teresa Frontato, our digital director. News director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. Our director of radio operations and technical director this hour is Peter Mertz. The director of radio programming at WLRN is Jason Zabka. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for calling and listening, texting and tweeting, and supporting public radio. The program is made possible by Willie the Bee Man.